Up next on Interviews with Innovators, host John Udell talks with Dr. Joel Salonicchio, the co-founder of Datadyne, a nonprofit consultancy dedicated to improving the quantity and quality of public health data. He works mainly in developing countries, where the dominant computer is the cell phone, and the dominant network protocol is SMS, a phenomenon that he calls the invisible computer revolution. From IT Conversations.
Well, good to talk to you again.
Yeah, pleasure. I'm glad you liked that article.
I thought it was great, actually. In fact, that's what I want to explore with you, is a number of points that you raised there, which I think are spot on. You know, starting with, it's just a rich country bias that we have desktops and laptops, and that's how we think about computing. And so we just don't really internalize the fact that for the majority of people in the world, that's not the experience. The experience is the phone. The phone is the computer.
I think the technology business, of course, is about creating great technology. It's also about the incentive of creating great technology because it's going to create great amounts of money. And I think, you know, you see the same thing within technology to some extent that you see within, say, public health, where, for example, I mean, you know, if malaria was still a problem in the United States, of course, we'd have a malaria vaccine.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And so, you know, to some extent, it's this, well, it's not our problem type of thing. Not that anyone within public health in the United States or at the pharmaceutical companies would sort of crassly say, we don't care about people dying about malaria, but they'd say, look, we're running a business here and there's no money in a malaria vaccine, so, you know, that's why we don't do it. And likewise, I think it's not that you'd find people in Silicon Valley who'd say, well, we don't care about aiding in development, et cetera. It's just they have other fish to fry at the moment, and they have all the incentives in the world to create stuff that addresses what we want here in the developed countries.
Do you agree with that, by the way? Do you think that there are, in fact, not interesting business models to be had out of serving this need of the majority of the billions on planet Earth?
No, in fact, I don't believe that you can't create good incentives to create the malaria vaccine, for example. I think that you easily could, and I think that you could also create great incentives or the incentives exist. It's also a question, I think, of what's the low-hanging fruit. I mean, you know, if you're a developer in Silicon Valley and you want to start, you know, creating great products for Kenya, I mean, you know, think of the sort of the hoops you've got to jump through or the obstacles in your path. I mean, you'd have to learn about Kenya. You'd have to probably get some people on the ground there. You'd have to do some, you know, I mean, you're immersed in, you are swimming in an ocean of technology in the United States,
mm-hmm.
you know, of high-speed internet, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't have to, you don't have to go through any of those hoops to really start thinking, if you're a creative person, to start thinking of creative, cool, potentially money-making solutions for technology in the United States.
EpiSurveyor, which is the open source data collection software that you've been developing, is being created by programmers who are located entirely in
India and Africa, in India and Kenya and South Africa.
So you point out, who's more likely to come up with innovative software based on the centrality of the cell phone, a programmer in Silicon Valley surrounded by beautiful desktops and laptops, or a programmer in Nairobi who lives in a world in which almost all contact with the network is via cell phone? So, great point.
Right. Well, I mean, and that's exactly what I'm saying. I mean, for the programmer in Nairobi, even a programmer who has high-speed internet and a laptop, even that programmer, like our programmer in Nairobi, I mean, he all around him is confronted with the reality of his countrymen who don't have that. And he, you know, I mean, our programmer, for example, I mean, he's, you know, he's very business-minded, and he's very much, I think, you know, thinking of killer apps he can write for that population,
mm-hmm.
because he knows that population. For, you know, for a programmer in Silicon Valley to kind of do the same thing, I think you have to broker the introduction. You know, you have to introduce them to, I mean, basically, if you had someone in Silicon Valley who really thought, just for whatever reason, look, either because I want to create some free software, or open source software, I want to give back, or I want to do something good for humanity, or I want to make a killing in fantastic software for developing countries,
mm-hmm.
for any of those reasons, you know, you'd have to have that drive that would have to be enough to make them jump over all the different obstacles in their path.
To come back to your piece, and the part that really grabbed me, you say the question we should be asking ourselves is not how can we buy and support and supply electricity for a laptop for every school teacher, much less every school child, but rather what mobile software can we write that would really add value for a school teacher or student or health worker or business person and that could run on the computer they already have in their pocket. So kind of a critique of the $100 laptop initiative as being at least not the priority.
There was a sort of discussion of that BBC article that that took place, a little sort of comment discussion on the Boing Boing website. And, you know, one of the things that they, you know, people, and I get this all the time, but one of the points that, that the commenters sort of kept making was they're sort of arguing about the processing speed of cell phones. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it enough? Not enough. People say, you know, you can't do anything. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but only slightly. You know, you can't do anything because a cell phone's not powerful enough to do anything.
Yeah.
And then someone else who says, well, you know, a cell phone's roughly equivalent to a computer of 10 or 15 years ago in terms of processing speed.
Right.
And so, you know, you of course you can. And I think that, let's put aside the issue of how we could do things with actually processing on a cell phone. Let's just talk about SMS for a second. I do, you know, I go to a little window in my browser and I do a Google search. I type a word in, some processing occurs in a computer far away from me, and then an answer is delivered to me. And that answer is a text answer. Now, Google already is providing SMS services, right? Mm-hmm. And those again, it's providing SMS services on my cell phone. It has nothing to do with whether I'm running a $50 cell phone or whether I'm running an iPhone.
Right.
The mediator is SMS. And Google is rightly recognizing, and even for people in developed countries, that for some things that's perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm.
You got to remember, I mean, suppose that you are a clinical officer and you're in some rural clinic in, you know, in southern Africa. You're out in the middle of nowhere. You don't have magazines. You don't have a newspaper. You don't have, you know, maybe you've got radio, but you haven't got any kind of computer, anything. But you have a cell phone. You know, for the last 2 years, there's been cell phone service, and you have one.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, when I'm in a clinic, I'm on staff at Georgetown Hospital. When I want to look something up, I just pick up one of the many books in the doctor's lounge, and I look up the dosage, or I look up a particular disease, or I look up and I can refresh my memory and look up new information in any number of ways just from things that are there. But suppose that you weren't. Are the people who say, oh well, these cell phones can't do anything because the processor isn't enough, I think are missing the point.
Yeah, I would never make that argument.
Right, I mean, because SMS, but I'm sort of giving it not because I think it's a very good argument, but I think it's important to sort of refute that argument because it shows people aren't even thinking in the right way.
Yeah.
I mean, just SMS gives us a gateway to all the information on the internet. Are you telling me that getting that information, regardless of the difficulties of SMS, regardless of the fact that, you know, you're limited by the size of an SMS message, et cetera, obviously I'm not arguing that, you know, that accessing things via text is the best way to always access it. But think about what you could do if you could give access to all the information on the internet to anybody with a cell phone. And then think about the fact that you can.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody only has to make the gateway connecting that information to all those cell phones out there.
Yes. Point well taken that, you know, the applications that matter to most people for the foreseeable future are not going to require a lot of processing, a lot of heavy graphics. I mean, it'd be nice things, but not required, right, for basic information flow.
You know, one of the things that I wrote in that sort of comment stream that I was mentioning, talking about that article, is that, you know, if you think about, you know, back before we had graphic interfaces and a mouse on our computer, et cetera. I mean, right, we wouldn't even provide those computers that we were using 15 or 20 years ago to developing countries because people would say, oh, that's ridiculous. They're way too primitive. I mean, we were so excited about that back then, and rightfully so, because it gave us the ability to do analysis and to do work that we had never been able to do before.
Sure. I mean, text-based BBSs were, and in many ways remain, an incredibly powerful thing that doesn't require any of the graphics or any of that.
Let me give you an example of something that we are funded to do, just a kind of proof of concept. We were talking about SMS before. I'm a physician in the United States, and I, in order to keep my license, I have to have continuing education credits each year. It means I have to attend a certain number of hours, typically 25 to 30 hours per year of education. And I can do that by going to lectures at hospitals, you know, where I work. I can do that by reading articles and filling out a form. I can do it online. I can do it on my cell phone. And again, I do it because it's required of me for me to keep my license. Now, in developing countries, most of the time, not only is there not a requirement, I mean, there's not a requirement even for physicians to keep their medical education up, much less for the clinical officers, the sort of high school educated maybe 1 or 2 years of college-educated clinical officers who provide the vast majority of the healthcare to the vast majority of the population in the world. And the reason that they've not received any continuing education after their initial training over a 20-year career is because ministries of health can't afford to travel everybody, all the health officers in the country, to the central location in the capital for training, and the mail system doesn't work, and no one can afford to subscribe to journals for these folks, and they don't have computers, and, you know, for that matter, they don't have television. So lots of different reasons why that's not been the case, and it essentially is a communications problem. We haven't had the ability to either transport or communicate enough to educate these folks. Well, the fact is that now most of those folks are carrying a cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, you know, one of the projects that we're just trying to implement, but we want to do at least a proof of concept, is the idea that if you train someone, for example, we're working with a project that's called Integrated Management of Childhood Illness, IMCI. So that's a WHO program that teaches very basic algorithms for treatment to health workers along the lines of, you know, if a child comes in, if they have fever, are they coughing? Yes. If they're coughing and they have fever, what's the respiratory rate?
So this works out to being some kind of an interactive decision tree-like application?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's not an application. This is something that they're trained in.
Okay.
But again, it's a really basic compared to the thinking that your doctor hopefully goes through when you come into the hospital, you know, with all the tools and diagnostics that your doctor has at his or her disposal. This is designed for situations where there are no x-rays, maybe not even a stethoscope,
yeah,
etc. Anyway, these folks get trained, and then they go out in the field, and then they, you know, practice for, let's say, 15 years, and they never get trained again. What we're saying is, I wonder what would be the effect if you were to regularly send these folks text messages that were derived from the same curriculum that they've been trained in.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the World Health Organization. It reminds me that another person I interviewed in this series is Barbara Aronson, who's the librarian with WHO and is the person most responsible for a project called HENARI, which is making biomedical research literature available at low or no cost to many of the poorest countries in the world. And, you know, it is, for that project, a huge issue about, you know, having people in even hospitals and clinics have sufficient internet access to be able to really consume this stuff effectively. And so that makes me wonder about, you know, kind of document design in a sense, right? In other words, if you were really serious about designing a body of literature that could be consumed in, you know, 140 character sips as well as page sized gulps, right? It would be, I mean, that'd be a pretty profound and deep and different way to approach document design, but it would be actually a pretty interesting problem to solve.
I completely agree. And again, I think that, you know, there are different things, I think, that are driving, for example, the spread of the web, of web-capable computers and high-speed internet. So that's a different economic situation than what's driving cell phones. You know, entirely different kind of economic perspective. And so it's not necessarily the case, for example, that cell phones and the web are going to spread at the same rate, or that it's inevitable, for example, that every village in Africa is going to wind up with high-speed internet eventually.
Right.
Because many villages in Africa, even under the old system, never wound up with a landline telephone, for example. And so, whereas I think it's very clear that these different incentives and disincentives are driving a huge expansion, a much greater expansion of cell phone technology. And so, yeah, I think the question that you bring up, you know, how could we parse this stuff to make it consumable by an audience that is going to be consuming it on a very low bandwidth environment, let's say, whether it's SMS or something else.
Well, not just low bandwidth, but you know, small chunks, right? I mean, it introduces a really profound constraint on document delivery. But it's one that, well, if you embrace that constraint, you can think of some. I can think of some interesting ways to approach it, right?
Well, also, John, though, keep in mind that, I mean, right now, the information, all the rich graphic interface information that you get when you're looking at your browser, is sent in chunks.
Yeah, I don't have to thread most of them together myself. But.
Right. You don't have to put them together yourself.
Yeah.
Now, there's nothing to say that you couldn't create an application that could run even a basic cell phone that could take SMSs formatted in a certain way.
Yeah.
and transparently unite those chunks.
Yeah.
So again, it's not necessarily that the person is going to have to be reading them in 140, you know, in these little SMS size bytes or chunks of information, right? I mean, you could easily render that transparent to the user.
There must, or well, I don't know, maybe there hasn't been any kind of work done to figure out what sort of a standard you could base something like that on. Have you run into things like that?
Well, I've run into folks who talk about it, like we talk about it. I think the general consensus seems to be that, you know, why bother? Because soon this stuff is all going to be obsolete. You know, why should we focus on that kind of stuff? And I think again, this really reveals a bias of the fact that, you know, most of the best developers are in the United States, where SMS, you know, SMS is really not a huge part of the way people interact with anything in the United States.
Although it's actually kind of comical how Twitter is the hottest thing on the block right now. And so suddenly all these people with their, you know, 2 gigahertz computers and, you know, huge displays are sending them each other, you know, basically text messages over the web, right?
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I've said the same thing.
Yeah.
It really is interesting. And again, I think, you know, there's lots of reasons why we don't particularly SMS in the United States. I think a lot of it has to do with the cost of calls. You know, in South Korea, where making voice calls was proportionally much, much higher, everyone was sort of driven by economics to SMS. And I think as the cost of voice calls goes down, I think you'll find that people will use it less and less. But still, in most developing countries, I think you're still in that kind of situation. But you know, getting back to this issue of continuing education, I mean, from my perspective as a public health doc, if I could, just by sending text messages, if I could say increase the clinical knowledge or slow the rate of loss of clinical knowledge of every health worker in sub-Saharan Africa through an automated system of sending out, you know, SMS messages, if I could raise that by 5%, I mean, basically what you're saying is you could increase the quality of care by 5% across all of sub-Saharan Africa simply by sending out text messages.
Yeah. When you say it that way, when you say by sending out text messages, it kind of causes people to leap to the conclusion that I did, that, well, you know, you're sending these little chunks and someone else is receiving these little chunks, and like human beings are interacting with small chunks, when in fact, probably the appropriate technological solution for this is, on the one hand, a publishing platform, which abstracts that chunking, and on the other hand, a reading application, which abstracts the chunking. And so, you know, at that point, it's just, from your perspective, it's no different, right? It's just straight document delivery and document consumption.
Right. And the kind of, I mean, I guess I'm so used to, you know, I'm kind of living in the world of, we need to get funding now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So for me, you know, when I talk about it, I tend to talk about the steps that we could take that would be the very next steps. As opposed to what you're describing, which I think is exactly right, which is what we're talking about in the 3 to 5 year ago. Which would be, I mean, I think the first steps, one, you know, there's lots of people who say that sending text messages of any kind, even sending things in little chunks, which essentially what they're saying is that sending information in small chunks to people could not in any way be useful. Now, obviously, I think that position is absurd. But we have to go through the process of doing proof of concepts and getting papers published and putting things out there for people to see that, no, it's not absurd. We've done it. And it makes a difference. Another example that we're working on would be just if you could just send reminders to the cell phones of families whose children are due for their vaccination.
Yeah.
I mean, just that. You could conceivably, I mean, I could easily imagine raising the vaccination rates in countries by 5 to 10% through such a simple mechanism. Right? So we have to go through the here and now of sort of proving the concept so we can get additional grant funding, so we can move forward and develop the kind of system that you're thinking about. And of course, clearly the idea here is that you want to make the process as easy or automated as possible. You know, certainly we don't want, you know, to have people sitting around there with cell phones, say, I mean, just to give a ridiculous example, you know, typing little messages in on keyboards of cell phones to go out across the developing world. No. You want to think of some sort of automated system.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be tremendously, you know, in the example of vaccinations, since most of the people who run vaccination programs, let's say in capital cities of countries, let's say in Bangkok, those folks do have access to the web. So you could build a web-based interface for an application. You could just have people enter, you know, here's the curriculum. in these SMS size chunks, and here's my list of users, you know, and here's, let me sort of specify what interval I want messages to go out to which subgroup of these users tagged in different ways.
So have you, by the way, run into a fellow Ken Banks? Do you know about his work?
Ken Banks? No, Ken Banks? I'm writing it down, but
yeah,
I don't know.
He's, well, you guys should, you should meet. I actually interviewed him for this series as well, and if you look it up, you'll find it. But he's got an SMS hub, basically, and so it forms the basis of an interesting kind of communication network for exactly the environment that you're talking about, where applications can be things like, oh, a job board, let's say, right? So you register with this job board, and if something in your category comes up, you get alerted, right? Or, you know, you have an application where you need to send broadcast notifications out to large numbers of people. So there's just, you know, a PC which serves as the hub, and then you register a bunch of endpoints with it and blast out those messages, right? And so it becomes a, you know, broadcast message distribution kind of thing too. It, yeah, you guys should know about each other, definitely.
I can tell you that by the end of the day, we will.
Yeah. To kind of then circle back to that question about, you know, is there a business model here? I'm kind of curious, you know, since the developers and presumably an emerging breed of entrepreneurs on the ground in these places are the ones that actually experience the need and understand the environment. Is there a business climate developing there, or you know, like what is the sand hill of sub-Saharan Africa, right? Or maybe there isn't one yet, but there should be, there could be, right?
I think there absolutely could be, but I'm not sure where it is. I mean, the person I'd love to ask that question to would be somebody like a Mo Ibrahim. I'm not sure. Are you familiar with him?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I don't know if it's an obvious question, but I find a lot of people in America don't know who this guy is, you know, who has sort of, you know, made $1 billion for himself providing cell phone access to people in Africa.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's, that probably would have a lot of ideas about business models and how they work in Africa. I mean, one of our funders is Vodafone Group Foundation, and of course that gives us access to Vodafone. And I mean, just in terms of, for me, the access that's most interesting is just access to the way that they're thinking.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, for me, we've been able to piggyback a lot of the stuff that we're doing on the back of basically, you know, business models. I mean, you know, they didn't invent PDAs for the purpose of public health, but we've done a tremendous amount. We've been able to do a tremendous amount of good in public health in terms of collecting data using PDAs that people designed so that people in America could keep track of their names and addresses.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, I mean, even more so with the cell phone network. So for me, I think one of the most fruitful parts of my time is when I can meet folks who are involved in you know, these huge businesses that are making tremendous profits in developing countries, like, you know, like Vodafone, for example. And thinking to myself, how can we adapt their strategies or work with them so we can basically get enough money to, you know, sort of siphon off some of that money to provide additional services. You know, we're hoping, for example, that if we can work up this news distribution via SMS thing, that we can use the same technology that we developed from that to do things like send vaccine reminders, etc. So,
yeah, and what is your take then on the $100 PC?
Yeah, I've had a lot of conversations with people about the OLPC, and I don't call it the $100 laptop, of course, because it's not a $100 laptop. It's a $200 or $300 laptop. To me, I guess my first reaction to that, I remembered a project called the Simputer project, and the Simputer project, I'm estimating, was probably about 10 years ago, and the idea was to build basically a Palm Pilot for developing countries. And the idea was it was a project based in India, and they were going to create this new hardware platform that was going to be $100. The $100, I guess, is this magic goal that we all shoot for. It was going to be $100, and it was going to, you know, have all these great features. And even at that time, I mean, that was when, of course, Palm Pilots were coming out, which is where they got the idea of creating this computer. And I remember, you know, discussing it with people and saying, well, you know, at that time, say 10 years ago, a Palm Pilot was $200 or $300. And how long do you think it's going to be before there's a $100 Palm Pilot? And, you know, the Palm platform's got 1,000 programs already written for it.
Yeah.
There's all these development tools, all this stuff, and we don't have to worry about the hardware at all. So if the natural way of things is for Palm Pilots to move to the $100 mark, which is, of course, exactly what they did. And I'll say handheld computers or PDAs in general, to move in that direction, then why would we need an NGO or a government program or a World Bank initiative to make PDAs cheaper? You know, I mean, that didn't make any sense to me. And my first reaction, to be honest, with the... and what happened with the Simputer, of course, was that, you know, I think the Simputer project is still sort of just barely hanging on, and it probably costs about $200. And, of course, you can buy a nice sort of smartphone for that price. Or if you want to buy an unconnected PDA, you can go out and buy one for $5 that runs 1,000 shareware programs. So I'm not really sure what the point of the Simputer project was. Now, with the OLPC, I think the OLPC had a lot more support and a lot more creative and interesting folks working on it. And so I think there have been... I think my fundamental criticism of the OLPC is the same as the Simputer.
Yeah.
I don't understand why we need a program to spend millions of dollars to make laptops cheaper when laptops get cheaper every year. You know, I mean, that would be like setting up a World Bank program to make water flow downhill.
I wonder if an OSPV, one server per village, would be a more appropriate kind of thing.
That's something that you're unlikely to get delivered.
Yeah.
By the market.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you think about it, right? I mean, you know, a ton of the innovation that's going on right now on the web has to do with people's ability to tap into, you know, quote unquote, cloud-based services, right? Using TCP/IP. Well, if you're not plugged into the cloud and aren't going to be anytime soon, then what's your platform for delivering services, right? So then I think actually it's kind of interesting to imagine, you know, a breed of low-cost server machines, you know, that could, you know, provide this, you know, some semblance of cloud infrastructure for the SMS network.
I think it's a great idea. And importantly, again, that's something that I don't sort of necessarily see the market just kind of coming out to provide or to meet that.
Yeah, yeah. So we've said a lot about how it may be very unlikely that large parts of the world are going to have internet connectivity for the foreseeable future. But what could overturn that assumption?
Well, you know, I mean, it's always a bad idea to bet against technology, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm looking at my iPhone that I'm making this call on, and I am still, you know, 6 months down the road, I am still perpetually astonished at this device that I have in my hand. I mean, at the amount of computing and the user interface that I have in my hand. I'll sort of half joking with people, I'll sort of talk about, well, you know, if you don't think we can provide a compelling or useful educational experience or computing experience on a cell phone, well, what about on an iPhone?
Yeah.
And then we'll say, well, you know, but that's $400. It's like, well, it's $400 now, but how long before we get a $100 iPhone? 3 years?
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, I think, you know, technology seems certainly to be relentless. And I think in the case of, you know, people are developing better compression algorithms all the time to move more data along the same pipelines. I think people are developing better pipelines all the time. Recent cutting of the... I'm not sure whether this has been an accident or some kind of nefarious activity, the cutting of the internet cables that supply most of the Middle East and India, for example. I think that reveals to us that obviously we're working on pretty limited bandwidth, even for large parts of the world. North Africa is not sub-Saharan Africa. You know, Cairo has excellent internet connectivity, but now you realize it's based on one undersea cable or two. So I think...
Yeah.
I think now that they're going to move to kind of address those vulnerabilities, I think because people see, okay, you know, people will be willing, countries will be willing to support expanding this infrastructure so we don't have these kind of disruptions in the future.
Yeah.
I think as more bandwidth comes on board, you know, you're going to see that pushed out to the frontier. You're going to see that pushed out to these rural villages. But again, I know that the cell phone and the laptop are different. They're different markets. And I'm not sure if the laptop is ever going to, you know, let's say the I'll call it the computer. Obviously, it's a trick, but, you know, desktop or laptop. I'm not sure if that's ever going to kind of get pushed out to every area.
It's more a case of leapfrogging, right? In other words, you know, parts of the world that never had a wired telephone infrastructure now never will need to have it, because they will simply leapfrog, right?
But what are the other, you know, what are the other sort of examples of leapfrogging? There's some of that being done with solar technology, with, you know, with energy production technology, but, you know, it's not like sub-Saharan Africa or Southeast Asia has leapfrogged past the television to something else. You know, it hasn't leapfrogged past the computer to something else. It's in many cases, you know, many places in the world, there's no computers and there's no television.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't leapfrog at all. And again, I can only think that that's because the market for those things is a different market than in certain subtle ways that I'm not able to yet appreciate. It's a different market than the market for cell phones. I think, you know, to be honest, I'm just dying to read, you know, the Harvard Business School review case study of, you know, cell phones in Southeast Asia. I mean, I don't see enough scholarship being devoted to what is, to me, the technology story of our time, you know, for the vast majority of the world, which is this explosion in cell phones.
Yeah.
How exactly has this happened?
Yeah.
Which is, again, why, you know, I want to either talk to Mo Ibrahim or listen to you talking to him to find out, you know, you were there at the creation. I mean, it'd be like talking to, you know, to Brennan Page, you know, say, well, exactly what happened at Google when you started there? I'd like to hear the kind of details.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But of course, I know a lot more about that story than I do about this miraculous story of how all of a sudden, you know, every health worker in Kenya has a pocket computer.
Yeah. It's great to talk to you again.
All right, man. I appreciate it.
Likewise. Take care.
Take it easy.
See you.
You've been listening to Interviews with Innovators with host John Udell.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was John Udell. Our website editor was Niels Makel. The series producer is Niels Makel.
This is Phil Wendley. I hope you'll join me next time for another great edition of Interviews with Innovators on IT Conversations.